Alrighty, we are back. This is Stephen McCarthy, and I'm with Richard Grove, who is a filmmaker, and I love the term forensic historian. I love history. I thought that was a great title. Is that actual a live title, Richard?
Yeah, forensic history is a real line of study, and the reason that I selected that, you know, because I used to say to label yourself is to negate most of your best aspects, and you know, allows you to be pigeonholed. So for a long time, I didn't want to label myself, but then people were like, you need to for this lower third or this show or whatever, they need a label. So forensic historian says, I study history, but I don't study it because that's what I want to do with my Saturday. I study it to find out about the crimes that are affecting human beings who are living today, and we only can understand what's going on today through studying history. And I see history repeats so much that, again, the only way we can stop history from repeating is to learn the lessons that it's teaching us. And if we haven't learned them yet, I thought maybe someone just hasn't created the right piece of media that presents it in a way that people can find it palatable. So that's what I try to do.
Amazing. Because it is true. I have to, again, put the word out. I have personally watched at least 25 hours or listened to 25 hours of your stuff, and I really find it to be very easy to access, you know, and you have it documented, you know, and you give it in big chunks, so it's not like you have to watch a reality show and you get 20 minutes every week and it takes you, you know, 18 weeks to get nowhere. So anyways, if anybody would like more information, it's tragedyandhope.com. That's the main site, and he has a lot of different products on there that I think you guys will all enjoy. But let's go back now to how do we change our current thoughts. And then before we had talked briefly about the genetic piece, and during the break we talked just briefly about your thoughts related to genetics, you know, and as it applies to sport. And in the current world, everybody thinks, well, if they find this magic gene inside somebody, they can then pick the number one draft choice, or he's going to be the next winner, or I can modify my DNA in some way to make him into the number one draft choice and become successful. Kind of give us background information and give us your thoughts related to the future application of that type of science.
Well, first, I would assume that most individuals don't really have this interest. The interest is generated by the business of sports. So, you know, individuals don't have the power to change their own DNA. We all got the DNA we got. And if you practice and be persistent, you can improve yourself in any skill area and, you know, in creation. But this starts back in, well, it starts in the 1800s. I don't want to go too back, you know, too far back in the history here. But there's this idea called eugenics. There's positive and negative eugenics. Positive eugenics would be improvements they could make, such as those that are usually found in the sporting business world. And negative eugenics is the process of eradicating the genes of lesser people, as the British would say. So these practices were adopted in America after starting in Britain. They were then adopted back over in Germany, where the Prussian education system came from. The Prussian education system produced the Nazis, and then the Nazis embraced eugenics, thinking it was a great idea. Now, because the Nazis gave this a bad name, the Rockefellers and the other people who were funding them, and that's not euphemism, I've got all the books on it, and the Rockefellers were funding these projects, and they decided to rebrand it as molecular biology. Now, the best book I could recommend, because people are saying, well, that sounds like a lot of speculation, I would point to a book published by MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, by Dr. Lily Kay, called The Molecular Biology of Life, Rockefeller, Caltech, and The New Biology. And it talks in depth about eugenics and how they rebranded it and what the purposes are. So all this DNA research into sports really comes from the same people that inspired the Nazis. So that's usually my problem with that area. But
now the question becomes, you know, does it have any application? You know, because I think, and this is just, an, again, my observation in my life, is that those are, you made a nice little progression up through the years as far as through history, through eugenics and into the Nazis and so on and so forth. But, okay, cool. That's going to take research. You have to do that on your own. But now we're here, and there's so many different people looking at the sports gene, or they see Usain Bolt, you know, that can run as fast as he can, you know, or he's you know, can run the 100-meter dash in 9.68 seconds. And I'm just trying, I don't know for sure if that's a number. But, or there's the, again, back to, you know, Kobe Bryant that can, you know, shoot 35 shots a game, and, you know, Adrian Peterson who can come back from an ACL surgery in 8 months and things like this. How do those things apply? Or is it just a false science or a pseudoscience because the foundation is wrong?
Well, again, we're talking about people with a very different philosophy. The people that are influencing those ideas from the top down have a very different philosophy. Their idea is that people are basically machines, that we are automatons, that we don't have a spirit or a soul. And a lot of athletes would argue with that because that's where your persistence and, you know, your imagination and your inspiration, all these things come from, the activity in the mind that brings these about. So, they treat us like we are clockwork oranges, to use a term from popular culture, that we can just be broken down into individual parts through DNA study. They can change some of that and rebuild it back up. Well, you're negating a lot of what, athleticism is, which is the mind, which they negate in their model in totality. So you see this creep of scientism into sports, and instead of focusing on what we can do naturally, it's all about what these corporations can synthetically provide, patent, make money from, you know, and do all these different things that I really think are alien to sports. They're not alien to business, but that's the 20th century phenomenon of the mixing of sports with, you know, international multi, you know, conglomerate businesses.
I'm going to ask another question that's totally off our subject, but it led us right here. Is one of the things that we always see as the owners of these sporting teams, and you referenced it earlier, is they are very well-to-do businessmen that supposedly are losing all this money on the sports team because they're just providing us good old-fashioned Americans as something that's good for our entertainment, if you will. Explain that a little bit more, what you just mentioned.
Well, okay, so, we're just laying out how the world works, really. There's a group of people of which you and I belong to, and we went through, likely, you know, public schooling, or, you know, we've been around people who've been in public schools our whole life. We really haven't been exposed to the mindsets of the people who create monopolies and create franchises and create multi-billion-dollar conglomerates that can be sold off to hedge funds and, you know, private equity firms and these sorts of things. That's the business world. So, really, what we do is, as athletes, is find ourselves playing a sport to a point where we want to be really good and maybe make a living at it. And in order to do that, you've got to do it that, you know, play ball. You got to play ball. And the people you're playing ball with have sold every inch of the stadium that they probably got public funds to build with private advertising. And there's all these layers of interest between government and local government and state government, federal government, private corporations, public corporations, all intermixing to try to get part of the vending, part of the ticketing, part of the parking, all these different layers that we're never taught about. And as an athlete, if you're trying to be a professional athlete and you don't understand the mechanisms that are driving the people writing your checks, you might not have a successful career off the field, even if you do on. So many people make millions and millions of dollars in their sporting career but don't have the intellectual self-defense to protect themselves from the predators and the wolves that really gave them that money as a loan because they knew you were going to spend it right back into their system. So that's kind of, you know, that's what I went through, but I also recognize that a lot of, you know, people who have been very famous in the sporting world have gone through a similar trip. And people today who are looking at going to be a professional sports person, I would consider all those levels and layers before you get too deeply involved into something where you've got 30 people around you who are all dependent on you playing on that team. So they're willing to bend the rules or lie to you or do whatever because they know if you lose, they lose. And that's a dangerous situation if you don't have the intellectual self-defense to be able to think your way out. But that's a result of how they've changed our thoughts as a whole across, you know, 300 million individuals in this country.
Now, this leads to another discussion that, again, is not originally on our intended direction, but I've thought a lot about this since I listened to your ultimate history lesson. In the boarding schools, in the elite universities, what is the role of sport in life? It is not necessarily so that you go out and be the next Kobe Bryant, not to be the next Shaq, all that kind of stuff. It's to understand how to problem solve, how to compete, go through pain, and more of those more common sense type of motives is what sport is made for, not for to become the next Kobe.
Well, I mean, you know, there has to be, there's going to be a next Kobe. I mean, that's how the system produces that. There's billions of dollars of advertising and marketing from shoes and apparel and jerseys and all this other stuff to groom little kids into being the next replacement part for that Lakers system, right? Because
yes.
It's a business. So they are out there producing, you know, replacement parts, and the way they do it is through clever marketing to our children and enforcing that in public schools where people have to, like, live up to the status symbols, right?
Yep.
So I'm not new to this game. And so when I found the value of John Taylor Gatto's work writing these books about how our American education system was crushed to make it a lot more like the British Empire system where we have castes and lots of different striations in our society and, you know, all the same things that are kind of shown in the professional sporting world. There's people that sit in the special box and there's people that sit in the cheap seats. And the people that sit in the cheap seats pay for the people that sit in the special box. I mean, so you have to understand these dynamics. And when you find out that schooling is no longer about individual accomplishments or problem solving or integrity, you say, oh, well, if they took those parts out, what would happen if we put those parts back in? So I said, you know, I tried to get a hold of John Taylor Gatto a couple different times over the years, and he was always traveling the world because he's spoken in like 90 different countries. And, you know, countries like China, the government of China will fly him out there to tell them, you know, here's the history of what how you guys got, you know, broken as well. Because the Japanese, the Chinese, they all inherited this Prussian education system, which, you know, some rich people in America brought over from Germany in the 1800s. So when you get down to it, trying to establish contact with a figure like John Taylor Gatto, who's, like, you know, always on the move, it's a hit or miss process. So you have to be persistent and you have to let some time pass. And, you know, luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity. That comes from Seneca, my favorite first century philosopher. And so I was persistent, and I got word back from John. And he said, yeah, give me a call. So I called him. He was in his barn. He had this barn in upstate New York, and he's out there working, chasing some raccoons out while he was looking for some books he had in storage. And so I'm talking to him. I'm like, yeah, this is kind of surreal. And so he says, yeah, what's your budget for this project? I was like, I don't have a budget. But I didn't tell him that. And I said, well, you know, what's your question? He says, well, you know, if you fly me up there, you know, this and that, and I'm thinking in my head, well, that's hundreds of dollars. I don't have money. So anyway, at the end of the conversation, I said, yeah, I'll give you a call back if that sounds good. And I got off the phone, and he says, like, we can't afford to fly him up here and do this sort of stuff. And I said, if we don't interview him, I'm like, what are we even here doing? I said, we'll figure it out. So I told John, I'm like, let's do it. And then I went to the subscribers of our community, because we have an online learning resource community where people listen to the podcast or watch videos. They can go there to learn and interact with other people, take it forward. And we raised the money to bring John here within like 24 hours. We bought the tickets, bought a little equipment to help make sure we could capture the moment in style. And, yeah, so he sat in our living room for 2 days, and we let the cameras roll. And he tells this amazing story. You know, step by step of how all of this happened and who did it and why they did it and what we can do about it. And he even lays out toward the end, you know, he went and talked to the people admissions at Harvard and Princeton, and here's what they're actually looking for. They're not looking for the next Kobe Bryant. They're looking for people who have individual accomplishments, who can, you know, kayak, you know, across the Atlantic or climb a mountain or, you know, ride across the Sahara on a pogo stick or something like that. And he's like, what they're looking for in the elite ruling class is totally different. It's antithetical to what we are all taught in this country. So, you know, while we're out there chasing these dreams sponsored by Nike, there are other people who are building empires and totally, like, raping and pillaging the resources of this country who were taught a very different skill set. And I'm just saying, you know, if we all had equal footing, if we had a level playing field, we all had access to these skill sets, what can we make the world into? It would have to be better than all of us not using our minds at all.
Exactly. And then wondering why it's not working. All right, so now we're going to move off to how. Okay, we're going to – because the biggest thing I want to share with everybody is that this is an amazing amount of research that I've done, you know, that Richard has done probably 30 or 40 times as much. And he has it all documented on his site. If you want to ask specific questions of us, you're more than welcome to go to his site and mine. But there is an amazing amount of information that you need to take the time to understand each one. But if we could come back now to say, okay, now we agree that there's a need to change and we've found out why. How do we do this? How do we start the process of learning, whether you're 30 years old, like, well, I was going to say like myself, I'm not 30, I'm 45. But if I was a young athlete, say I'm 16, 17 years old, and I'm like, dude, you're making sense to me. How do I change this so that I can compete at a highest level?
Well, that's a complex question, but I'm prepared to answer it. relating to what you said right before you asked the question, there's a contact tab at the top of tragedyandhope.com. So if you have a question or there's something like that, that's how you contact. And you know, also on that page, conveniently enough, there's one that says podcast, which comes to answering your question. What you need to do as an individual is figure out, how can I get more out of the same 24 hours that everyone else is using, you know? There's any number of great inventors or great minds over time. It's like those guys had 24 hours a day as well. So what are you doing that where you could be doing more? If you're driving a car or mowing the lawn or cleaning your garage or taking a run or kayaking across the lake or whatever, you could be listening to a podcast like this one, you know. Or you could also listen to other podcasts like mine, Peace Revolution. And what I would say is, you know, in trying to make a habit change, pick five episodes. Listen through five episodes before you decide if you like it or don't like it, because you can't tell what the podcast is from just one episode. I purposely create all the episodes a little bit different, but a little bit the same, so they're useful but also unique. And so if you, you know, just need, let's say, if you just need a convincer, I would say the 23rd episode of my podcast, Peace Revolution, How to Free Your Mind, is particularly useful because it teaches you how to learn anything for yourself. And once you know that, you can really do anything you want with a little practice and persistence. So it's a true key to life that has been occulted or hidden. It's not scary information. It's just very powerful when other people have it and you don't. That creates a power differential. That's leverage. That's the wealth gap. That's the power gap. It's the knowledge gap. It's everything. So very valuable information. Peace Revolution, Episode 23, How to Free Your Mind.
Now, this is another piece, too, because inside – because I'm going to keep coming back to the John Taylor Gatto thing, because inside of that, I watched, I'm just going to put that in there. I'll let you kind of let us know where it's at. But he had mentioned in there that like Thomas Edison and Ben Franklin and all these guys were starting to do things at a younger age, like 11, 12, 13, where they were starting to put the thoughts together. In America, we say, okay, you got to go to college. And I just read something else today that they're not going to, they're going to name an adult at 25, not at 18. You know, trying to extend this idea.
I read that too. We can talk about that.
Okay, go for it.
Yeah, Tavistock Institute. That's some deep stuff. There could be a whole episode just on that. Extended adolescence.
But you think about it, it's like, and the reason I brought it up was more so to realize that 12 and 13-year-olds can take these tools that you put out in that film, but also probably, I'm sure, on that podcast number 23 that you just mentioned.
Well, again, it goes back to what we could actually do with our potential, and what the system wants to do is govern our potential so that it is technically, so it's retarded, so that it's artificially held back, so that if it shows up, it shows up too late in life where you're already entrapped in the system by a thousand different little threads that they've got you by. So really, you need to take life by the short hairs. You need to start early in life. You need to gain these tools. You know, parents pick them up first and teach them to your kids. They're very simple tools. It's not rocket science. But the rocket science comes in hiding it from everybody because it's available to a certain group of people and not available to us, really. So, you know, Ben Franklin, there's any number of useful examples. Ben Franklin wrote a short and easy-to-read book called The Autobiography of Ben Franklin by Ben Franklin. And in there, he describes, you know, here's what he was doing. He was running businesses. He would come up with creative ideas, you know, and this is how he came to, you know, live a life that was very full. Now, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of negative information out there about Ben Franklin. You can do some research. I'm not saying he's a perfect guy. I'm just saying in this one area of, you know, how much you can learn at a young age and continue being fruitful through life, that is a very reputable and substantial example that you could, you know, fill yourself with in one afternoon. It's a very short book. It's like 50 pages. And it's written in, you know, very simple English so that anybody of any age could really, you know, start to read it and reread it as you go through life and compare and see where you are. But yeah, these tools are out there, they're available, and they're very valuable. I mean, if you have a goal in life, you know, if it didn't depend on physical prowess, because that's up to you. But if it has anything to do with mentality, I can teach you how to get that job. If you wanted to be, you know, a CEO, if you want to be a president, if you want to own a team, if you wanted to buy a business, those are things that are very easy and simple to teach. And they're skills and habits that you can pick up easier if you start with changing habits, you know, like a small habit, like listening to a podcast instead of watching TV or listening to the radio and the commercials and having to change stations all the time. You know, that's why I have no commercials. So you could just hit play and let it go.
Which is thankful. I have to admit, I love listening to your stuff because you can get an hour. You know what I mean? It's not like 20 minutes and they were talking about how reality TV where they give you 3 minutes and then they have to repeat that 3 minutes plus 3 minutes more and you only get 20 minutes and a half an hour, y'all, this kind of stuff.
The format on TV is even worse where they, you know, before they go to commercial, they tell you something and when you come back, they show you what you just saw. So I just, you know, I needed something to fit my own lifestyle. And my lifestyle demands that I don't reach over and try to press fast forward or pause or mute or whatever every couple minutes. You know, and I know there's people out there running or driving. It's dangerous, you know, to go looking for your fast forward button or whatever. So it's like, here it is. It's there. If you want to actually, you know, fast forward to a certain hour, cool. But you won't have to fast forward through commercials. You won't have to mute stuff out. You know, I very rarely use expletive words. I just tried to make it as easy for people to change their habits as possible. It's a simple format. It's always chock full of useful information that I pretty much guarantee that you're not getting other places. Otherwise, I would be listening to that podcast and not making one.
That's probably true. All right, so now let's go down to it because I just thought of another area that in the world of sport is amazingly overhyped. SATs and GPA, you know, and you got to have your GPA really high and you got to have a SAT score and more has to do with the minimums, not necessarily the top end, but in sport, it's always about getting these certain tests. And again, you cover this in the ultimate history lesson and this standard of excellence versus the GPA and SAT. How do those all kind of bind together and what should athletes do instead of pursuing SAT and GPA?
Well, that, again, is a complex question, but I can probably give you a pretty good answer to it. First off, SAT and GPA, those are useful metrics for people who are seeking interchangeable parts, okay? Colleges, sports teams, corporations, those types of places will look for those types of readily available interchangeable parts. I don't happen to be an interchangeable part, so I had a great GPA through high school. Didn't really do me any good in the corporate world or in life. You know, I had respectable SAT scores. I graduated from a respectable university. You know, I got the certificate. I never had to show a transcript or proof of graduation because why I was getting hired was not because of that. I was being hired because I knew how to make myself a fountain of utility and adapt and evolve and overcome in business situations. And those are things that they don't teach in any of these colleges. I taught myself how to do sales and run my own business. Again, no degree in sales is available at any of those colleges. So the real reason was because I knew how to build business relationships and I knew how to bring value strategically to high levels of executives. And those, again, do not come from interchangeable parts. So my advice would be, if you want to be an interchangeable part, focus on those things. I got a buddy here who's a colleague who teaches an SAT class. Take a class. But if you really want to excel in life and suck the marrow out of life, you cannot follow that path because that path is prescribed, as Gatto explains in the Ultimate History Lesson, for creating, you know, it's chopping off all your uniqueness and making a circle out of you so you're an interchangeable cog in their machine.
Unbelievable. All right, we're going to go to a break again, and then we'll come back and finish up our discussion related to how to become a creative, imaginative, self-confident person.